good one, Rory.
Thank you, Brian. What can we do without him? This morning is a book launching. We have Associate Professor Stephen Petro introducing Richard Davis's book on Smith O'Brien. And that's all I need to say. We're very fortunate to have Stephen. I don't know if he's skipped anything important. So, please welcome Stephen Petro.
Thanks, Leonie, and thanks everyone for attending on this very cold day. Well, the author of the book that I'm launching today is no stranger to regular attenders of the marvellously diverse offerings of U3A Hobart. Richard Davis has presented a number of courses at U3A, and probably many in this room have attended at least one. As you know, before retirement, Richard taught history for many years at the University of Tasmania. He is now an Emeritus Professor of History and a Fellow of the Australian Academy of the Humanities, an honour bestowed on scholars who have made a distinguished contribution to their discipline and in their discipline. In addition to teaching, Richard has published widely on Tasmanian, New Zealand and Irish history. He's published much work on the Young Ireland movement and in the 1990s published the most significant biography of William Smith O'Brien, leader of the Young Ireland movement, called Revolutionary Imperialist. Richard also published O'Brien's valuable journal of his years in Van Diemen's Land, called To Solitude Consigned. O'Brien had been transported to Van Diemen's Land after the failed rebellion of 1848 in Ireland, along with other young Irelanders, including most famously Thomas Marr, but also John Martin and Terence Bellew McManus. Richard has continued to find new things to say about the remarkable William Smith O'Brien, and in his new book, Travels of William Smith O'Brien in Europe and the Wider World, 1843 to 1864, the book I'm holding up to you now, very fine production, Richard has ventured into new territory, a new kind of history, tourism history. The core of this book summarises with quotations all of O'Brien's travel journals from 1849, when he was transported, to 1864, when he died, and was made possible by the acquisition of new O'Brien papers by the National Library of Ireland. The result is a detailed picture of one of the great travellers of the 19th century. Drawing on earlier work, Richard introduces us to O'Brien in the first two chapters, providing an overview of O'Brien's life, education and political career to 1848, and his exile in Van Diemen's Land, with his travels given prominence. Even in his youth, O'Brien had been a keen traveller in foreign climes. Part of his early education had been in France and England. In 1829, he visited Holland, Belgium and northern Germany. And in 1833, spent his honeymoon in southern France and Switzerland. Why wouldn't you? His most significant travelling before his exile to Van Diemen's Land occurred in 1843 during a parliamentary break. He was a politician. Then he toured some of the countries of Central and Northern Europe, Belgium, Germany, and the expansive Austrian Empire, which 5 years later was thrown into turmoil by revolution. Been holding back revolution for a number of decades. During this latter trip, O'Brien developed what Richard calls a travel template that he followed for the rest of his life. His detailed journal recorded observations on working conditions and wages, political systems, religion, education, and how modern developments had erased local customs, manners, and languages. Moving rapidly from place to place, O'Brien usually spent one day in each city or town, much as Japanese tourists do today, don't they? They rush around, walked around the streets while there, forming opinions and collecting as many facts as he could. O'Brien's trip confirmed that political change was needed in Ireland and persuaded him to join Daniel O'Connell's Repeal Association. But once the potato famine broke out in 1845, he realised that political measures were not going to be enough. Force would be required to break free of English rule, and he formed the Irish Confederation. This led to the failed 1848 rebellion and his transportation to Van Diemen's Land, by far the longest and most trying trip he had yet made. O'Brien was confined for 1 year at the penal settlements of Maria Island and Port Arthur, but after accepting a ticket of leave, spent time at Avoca and New Norfolk, a district he became very familiar with. O'Brien's Van Diemen's Land Journal was so full of descriptions of nature, he was, you know, a nature lover, that Richard suggests that O'Brien can be placed as a forerunner of Bob Brown. There is a connection. If you've got to read To Solitude Consigned as well as this book. By both. Richard had made use of the recently discovered final months of O'Brien's stay in Van Diemen's Land in 1853-54, when O'Brien was allowed to move more freely around the island and spent some time in Hobart and Richmond. In May 1854, O'Brien received news that the British government had granted him belatedly a conditional pardon, which meant he could travel anywhere in the world except Britain or Ireland. O'Brien appreciated the many kindnesses that he had received in Van Diemen's Land, and he travelled around the island to thank people personally for those kindnesses. He had made friends here that really helped him survive in Van Diemen's Land, and as he went, he recorded his impressions of places and people before he left for Victoria on the 8th of July. And he visited Melbourne, Geelong and parts of rural Victoria, receiving enthusiastic receptions from Irishmen, a lot of Irishmen in Victoria. After leaving Victoria in July 1854, O'Brien spent much of the next 10 years travelling in India, Egypt, many countries in Europe, and the United States and Canada, with a 2-year interlude back in Ireland, where he was finally allowed to go. This period makes up the bulk of Richard's book and provides much rich detail on what O'Brien experienced. The way that O'Brien recorded his conversations with the many people, high, low, and in between, that he met on his travels, helps him avoid writing a standard guidebook of tourist sites, although that's inevitable as part of the process. Can't completely get away from that, but he does try and avoid that. And he takes us, as he took himself, beneath the surface of the places he saw. It's those personal contacts that makes this such an interesting book. O'Brien, in a sense, was an ideal traveller, interested in everything, but obsessed with mountain scenery, able to walk long distances without tiring, and to eat and sleep at any hour. Sometimes he travelled with his son, Edward, but mostly he travelled alone. When travelling alone, at least, he rarely had a planned itinerary and liked to improvise rather than plan his movements. Now, I don't have time today in introducing this book to talk at length about all these travels. So what I'm going to give you is a flavour of what you'll find when you read the book and discover the reflections of this passionate traveller. Well, in Asia, he spent time in India and was horrified to note that Indians had a lower living standard than even the Irish. He dismissed as an absolute mockery the excuse that Hindus were happy with little. That's an English, excuse. At a Hindu wedding, O'Brien was much taken with the dancing entertainment provided by a professional dancer, which he had to tell us he found not to be indecent, so he must have found it to be indecent, and probably resembled the dancing in a Bollywood movie. I'm not going to give you an example of what that actually was. In his two-volume book, The Principles of Government, published in 1854, O'Brien denounced how the natives of India had been, quote, systematically plundered both as nations and as individuals upon every imaginable pretext. O'Brien's travels convinced him that men, quote, differ little in the fundamental qualities of mind and of heart. And when you read that, you know, that is a very good justification for all of us, for everyone, to travel. You know, to bring people, if you travel, you bring people together, you may well avoid conflict. Now, maybe I'm being too heavily influenced by O'Brien's idealism there, but I think it's true. In Spain, he was impressed with the splendid black eyes of Spanish women and with the equally splendid collection of paintings in the Prado, the best collection of paintings in the world, he claimed. He thought Madrid second only to that most beautiful city, Paris, as a European capital. O'Brien was reunited with his family in Brussels, and this ended his journal, which he had written in part for his wife, Lucy, but also with an eye to later publication. Thereafter, his writing was Notes Richard, even less a guidebook or place for thoughts, but somewhere to record his fleeting impressions. Like many a modern traveller, O'Brien wrote rapturously of his trip down the Moselle and Rhine rivers and of his walks in the forests of Fontainebleau, where he exulted in nature's grand solitude and gained refuge from the polluting cities of Belgium and France. Natural beauty impressed O'Brien more than anything man-made, and so he was overwhelmed when travelling across the Alps, which he described as a sight more sublime than ever created by human hands. He was still impressed, however, with the many paintings and sculptures in Florence, with the Venus de Medici being one of many marvels in that wonderful city. He was also he also expressed awe as he approached the eternal city, Rome, but when he reached it, was disillusioned by its smell, dirt, and failure to look after ancient buildings and monuments. He was impressed, with the interior of St. Peter's and in the Vatican some statues such as the Apollo Belvedere. O'Brien found Naples more to his liking and found it impossible to describe the wonderful view from Mount Vesuvius. His visit to Pompeii was ruined by too many tourists, one knows the feeling, and elsewhere the Neapolitan beggars drove the frugal O'Brien mad. It had things to do with his money. No. Though even poorer, and this is really interesting, Sicilians, because we know how poor Sicily was, Sicilians were not as greedy or as intrusive as those beggars in Naples, and O'Brien found Messina a noble city. O'Brien later visited Venice and found much of interest, but his favourite Italian city remained Naples, and on a later trip there he noted that the Bay of Naples gave him more pleasure than all of the antiquities in Rome. Interestingly, he found Lake Como less beautiful than the lake at Killarney in Ireland. In Greece, the problem was finding suitable furnished accommodation. There was no TripAdvisor on the internet then. But this was compensated by the numerous historical places he visited and his avoidance of brigands who infested the country. They're called banks these days, aren't they? The friendly Greeks were just one oppressed nationality whose cause O'Brien supported, seeing many parallels with Ireland. After he finally received his free pardon in 1856, O'Brien was naturally enough impatient to return to his home country, but as he made his way there, was continually annoyed at having to show his passport so often because it indicated, he wrote, the distrust on the part of the authorities towards all mankind. When O'Brien returned to Ireland in July 1856, he intended never to leave again. He reconnected with his homeland by what else? Travelling in the west of Ireland. But his restless spirit needed a new travel fix. He decided to go to America and Canada in what became a highlight of his post-Van Diemen's Land career. He wanted to see a republic in action and see how the Irish adapted to America. He was flattered by his positive reception in New York, another great Irish city, where he started his North American odyssey, but became exasperated, even worn out, by the constant receptions he met with all over North America, America and Canada. He shared trains with ordinary people who continuously chewed tobacco and, health warning here, expectorated green liquid. He was disappointed that Americans favoured material comfort over artistic development. In North America, Quebec was his favourite city. I haven't had the pleasure. Interestingly, he approved of the American right to bear arms and wanted the same right for the Irish. not much chance of that. O'Brien's 3 months in North America did not quench his wanderlust, because Richard obviously makes the point that travel for O'Brien had become a psychological necessity. And he continued his travels in Europe in 1860. Off he went to Spain, where Toledo, Valencia and Granada impressed in different ways. But he also visited Portugal, where the sight of a bullfight drew the comment that, quote, the bull was a nobler animal than the men who find delight in torturing him. His wife's premature death in June 1861 prompted another bout of travelling to overcome his grief. Travelling also helped him to cope with the transfer of the family home to his son in 1862. And in the next 3 years, his therapy continued with return visits to France, the German states, Austria, Hungary, where he met quite a few, you know, well-known leaders and other people. And he also went to Italy. And interestingly, until I'd read this book, I didn't know that there was a town called Gallipoli in southern Italy. And he went to Greece as well. But he also went further afield this time. He went to more exotic places, perhaps, like Turkey, Transylvania, and Poland. And in Turkey, O'Brien exulted in the historical associations and architecture, but condemned the way in which Turkish women were treated. Despite the striking looks of the men and women, Transylvania did not impress O'Brien, who had few complimentary things to say about a place so lacking in the comforts of civilization. His experience of Poland and Lithuania brought him into contact with relatives who'd settled there, and seeing so much in common with Ireland's position, he developed great sympathy for the resistance movements against Russian control. You know, Poland's history is such a sad one, isn't it? Very much like Ireland's. And this sympathy of O'Brien for Poland came out very strongly in his belief, quote, that for every Pole being shot or put to death in cold blood, a Russian officer should die the death of a dog by way of reprisal. Soon after these trips, O'Brien returned to Ireland in late 1863. He began thinking about travelling again, but died in June 1864 before thoughts became action and put an end to the remarkable journey of this intrepid world traveller. So this book that I'm launching today, published in Ireland by Geography Publications, is splendidly produced. The font is a very good size for someone whose eyes, you know, need a very big font, very easy to read. And you whip through this book for all sorts of reasons. One of them is that Richard's writing keeps us moving along at a steady pace. We want to know, what is O'Brien going to find next? What is he going to see? What is he going to say about it? There are many individuals mentioned. Helpfully, Richard includes images of many of those people in the text. Also, maps of places mentioned, which is absolutely essential in a book of this kind. And Richard also provides connecting text to explain to us, to remind us very briefly about wider developments in European history. So I think I can fairly say, and enthusiastically say, anyone who has been a tourist or a traveller, anyone who enjoys reading about Irish, European and Tasmanian history, and there aren't many books like that, and anyone who likes to read about the great cities of the world, and of course anyone who has developed an interest in the life of William Smith O'Brien, will find this book an indispensable addition to their library. Now I end my journey by launching The Travels of William Smith O'Brien. And I think we now need to hear from the author, so please welcome Richard Davis to the podium.
Well, thank you very much indeed, Stefan. As I'm sure everyone will agree, that was a most sympathetic and sensitive description of a book. And I would like, before I go further, to thank all the people that have helped from time to time in my many years of working on Smith O'Brien, my wife Marion in particular. Smith O'Brien has been a member of our household for nearly 30 years. And also people like Kate Walpole, who's done a lot for the project.